listening to North Atlantic Radio with your hosts, Brian Zuta and Matt Rigott.
Welcome one and all to the final episode in Series 1, Episode 11 of North Atlantic Radio. This episode, we will be talking again about paywalls, this time from a technical perspective. We'll be doing the usual heroes and villains, side of the episode, and the books we've been reading. In fact, we've just finished recording the bulk of the podcast, and my usual question for you, Brian, how do you think it went?
Better than normal. I don't think we stopped. We had one issue with Skype this week, which is down from the usual two or three. And I don't think we haven't really stumbled over anything. We managed to talk for over a half hour.
But, yeah, we've been very...
That's my problem.
Very speedy this time. Got it all done much faster than usual. Small problem with a man. It was your neighbor trying to drill holes in your wall while we were recording. But the consummate professionals we are, we've managed to get around that.
Yeah, and I think with a little bit of GarageBand magic, you will never even know.
We're recording this podcast the day that the New York Times announced its intention to introduce a paywall to its site in, well, early 2011 is all they've said so far. And in the lead up to that, and I'm sure in the days after that, there'll be plenty of talk about paywalls. And if you're a long-term listener to the podcast, you'll know that it's a subject Brian and I are very interested in. So we thought we'd... rather than just talking yet again about the advantages and disadvantages of paywalls, we thought we'd take a slightly different slant in this last episode of Series 1 and talk about the technical implementation of paywalls. So we're going to assume, we'll probably drift into this anyway, but we're going to assume that the argument is for or against paywalls has been decided, and it's more about the implementation of paywalls. There's a really good article by Felix Salmon in Reuters, or on the Reuters website, about how the New York Times should construct its paywall. Talking about whether they should go for a system like the Financial Times, where you can read 10 articles in a month, but once you get to that 11th, you have to pay, and you have to pay a huge sum. And in fact, Felix Salmon is arguing against this, saying it's a terrible system because you get 10 for free, you have to pay a huge sum for that 11th, and then 12th, 13th, 14th, the more you read, the less that amount becomes per article overall. He's saying that the Financial Times system is a terrible, terrible system, and the system they should go for instead is micropayments. So continual small payments, like you pay, I don't know, say a penny for each article in the New York Times, and saying that that's a much better system for plenty of reasons. But have you got any opinions on that? Which one you prefer to see?
Yeah, with micropayments, you're paying 1 or 2 cents every single time. And you know, there's the whole psychological, if something costs $1, you know, it doesn't matter. If it costs 99 cents, in your head, it's the same amount, but there's one penny difference. Now, if we go from free to one penny, it's no different than 99 cents to a dollar, but there's a huge psychological thing. You know, you've got to get your wallet out. You've got to waste the time for a penny. And most people just don't care. There's a third option, I guess. Instead of getting 10 free, paying for your 11th, and basically the 11th is subsidizing those previous 10, you could just pay a subscription fee where it's, you know, $10 a month or $10 a year unlimited, but you pay it before you even view your first article. That's, you know, the kind of magazine subscription, and I think that's probably what we're most comfortable with. I mean, that's the way we pay for cable and other services.
Yeah, I mean, the problem with that is that they'd lose any how would people continue to find the New York Times interesting? If anyone comes to the site and they immediately have to subscribe before they can see anything on the internet, I mean, people are just going to walk away. So I think that's a bad implementation. Plus, with that, what you end up doing is you end up charging the people that your most loyal customers, because they're the ones that are going to come back and again. And, you know, I guess traditionally in business, your repeat customers are the ones that you give discounts to, whereas in the case of a paywall where you demand a subscription, you're asking your loyal customers to pay up, and the people that come to your site regularly are either, well, they're not going to pay anything if they look at under 10 articles a month, or if you're demanding a subscription from them straight away, they're not going to see anything at all. So you're not going to make any money from them.
There's several different systems for converting free, you know, free news into paid news. Obviously, there's a username and login. So, you know, I would sign up with my email address, have a password, and my account would get debited. There's a few of the ways they're doing it now, like the FT, I think it either sets a cookie, so you visit the website three or four times, and then the fourth time it says, sorry, you have to pay. You know, the simplest techie way around that is, you know, clear out your cache, empty your cookies, and you're back. The other way they can do it is by IP address, but that kind of hurts if everyone in you know, at your work is going out of the same, you know, same router, the same IP address. So the technical implementations for kind of besides the name and password are always either circumventable or are hurting more than one person at a time.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, the paywalls that we've seen so far, they're all fairly easy to circumvent. I mean, you need a certain amount of technical knowledge, which is maybe why the companies have just decided it's good enough. But yeah, you mentioned the FT, you get to three articles, I think, or 10 maybe, and you can't access any more that month, but that's fine because you just delete the cookie and you're good to go. The Washington, what's the paper? Is it the Washington Post, the Washington Journal? Wall Street Journal. Is that right? How does that one work? Ah, my mind's gone blank as well.
I think that one is a username and password, but it's free to sign up.
Ah, yeah, but and that's it. If you go to the Wall Street Journal, you copy and paste the headline and copy the headline, paste it into Google. You can get access to the article for them because the Wall Street Journal gives free access to Google, so that's fine. So you can circumvent that. We came across I think it's the New Scientist magazine has just implemented a paywall, but their paywall's entirely in JavaScript, again probably cookie based. So if you go to a page and you've already looked at, I think, maybe 10 articles in that month or something, it puts a JavaScript pop-up over the article so you can't read it and says, oh, you need to subscribe. But that's fine. You turn off JavaScript and you've got full access to the site. So there's not been no major company has implemented a paywall yet that's kind of rock solid without being able to be circumvented. So the argument there, I guess, is that you either say, well, screw it, it's good enough, you've got techies, but they make up 10% of our audience, we can live with that loss of earnings, they're not going to pay anyway, or you look for something that works purely server-side, I guess.
The way the Kindle works is it kind of flips the subscription model on its head in that you pay to download blogs, which seems silly because you can look at a blog for free. But with the Kindle, your internet connection is free. So whereas with, you know, your laptop or your iPhone, you pay for the data plan. So they've kind of taken it the other way around on the Kindle. And even on the iPhone, there are a few magazines who you might be able to read their stuff online for free, but they will sell you a nice laid out iPhone app for 99 cents or $1.99. And I think people are willing to pay for that probably for two reasons. A, it's a new medium, so they don't have the expectation of it being free. And secondly, it also offers benefits. Like, I can read magazines offline. I don't need to use a data plan to read all these articles. I can read it, you know, in a tunnel or in the tube or something where you don't necessarily have a cellular connection. Or in the case of the Kindle, you can be out in the middle of the woods and you know you're not sucking down, you know, 3 gigs or 3 megs on a data plan costing you a small fortune.
Right.
Because
you've hit the nail on 99 cents. Yeah, you've hit the nail on the head there, I think, actually. The new medium, people don't bring any preconceptions to. And yeah, if you get some kind of benefit from it. Was it last month when we talked about the Guardian's iPhone app? I mean, the Guardian website's free, but I happily paid £2.50 for the app because it gives me the benefits of offline access. The interface is much nicer, much faster than the website. So yeah, I think with the tablet, the Apple tablet, and, you know, equivalent things like the Kindle, it could well be that they can make money through that. But that can only be a small amount of income for the paper. So the paywall well, has to succeed in some way, I guess.
Next section, we're going to talk a little bit about our heroes and villains since our last podcast. At least this is going to be the, you know, last heroes and villains for a while until season two. Then we'll have a lot of time to build up some love and hate in between then. But this week, or this episode, Matt, who's your hero?
This episode, my final hero of the episode is Google. Very, very popular story. Google standing up to the Chinese government. It seems to have come out that in 2006, when Google went into the Chinese market, they had arguments at board level as to whether that was a good idea or not, whether it was kind of they were going against their principles of not being evil by censoring their search results. But they obviously did decide to go into the Chinese market eventually, and now after getting fed up with their treatment by the Chinese government, they've said enough is enough. We're not happy with this. We're not just going to roll over and let this happen. So China either sorts themselves out or we go. And it's great to see a company standing up against a country. I mean, interesting in a political level, the fact that countries now have to deal directly with companies, and you know, the companies have such sway with the countries. But it's great also to see, you know, Google standing up to China, something you don't see very much of at any level. So they're my heroes this week. And yours, Brian?
I was going to go with TweetCC. It's a project that I was working on. It's 1 year old this month.
Does that mean you're your own hero?
In a small way, yes. it's the last episode. I might as well. But basically, TweetCC was a way to license your, or declare a declaration, Creative Commons, public domain, or other, on your Twitter stream. And in the last year, we've gotten a little over 3,400 people who have pledged their Twitter messages in some sort of Creative Commons or license format for others to use, mix up, and mash.
Okay, and your villain?
My villain? Recently, since our last podcast, Apple and Nokia have just been going nuts toward each other. Partly because I think Nokia claims to have a lot of patents on phone technology. Apple has other patents on phone technology, and they're threatening each other for interfering and using each other's patents to the extent where, you know, Nokia is trying to stop Apple products from being imported, and Apple's threatening the same. And at the end of the day, the patent office needs a bit of a reform, and it's just stifling a lot of creativity. Some of the more obvious things, you know, touch an icon. If people own a patent on that, it stops, you know, other phone manufacturers, and it's just not good for the end consumer that these titans are suing each other, yeah, at our expense. So they're my villains this week.
Yeah, likewise, my villain this episode, paradoxically, is my hero, Google, for the same sort of thing, just getting involved in patents. It's an unfortunate part of modern software development that the companies decide to patent everything they possibly can to kind of stem competition. And Google have done, Google have gone and patented a MapReduce algorithm for distributed computing, which means that their competitors are going to have to deal with that, as well as the problems inherent to distributed computing as well. So good Google, bad Google. Site of the episode, final one of the series, is the very, very soon to be launched data.gov.uk. The day we're recording this was the site was in preview, almost like a beta mode, and they were promising to launch tomorrow morning. So it should be up for you by the time you listen to this. It's down as we record the podcast at the moment, but Brian and I both had a look at it earlier and quite impressed. Well, you said it was very different to data.gov, didn't you, the US version? So data.gov.uk is the UK government's portal for data sets. So just to make that clear, the US government have had one for a while, and data.gov.uk has just been previewed at the moment. Sorry, Brian.
No, it's okay. I was just going to say that the data.gov one, if you just take a look at the top-level navigation, it's got, you know, catalogs, state and local, FAQs, suggest data sets, agency partnerships, about, and a blog. And the data.gov.uk one had things about, you know, Sparkle endpoints, RDF. It had a wiki and a forum. So even though they're both doing a lot of the same, serving the same purpose of getting data out there to mix up and mash up, it was very different kind of approaches. One's very, you know, the data, the US data.gov is very much kind of, I guess, top down. Here's our, you know, ontology and structure of state, local, and data sets. Where the UK one seemed to be much more wikis and forums and trying to build a community around it.
Yeah, I think the US sites will have been written kind of by civil servants, or civil servants having an idea of the structure of government. The UK one, data.gov.uk, it's very clearly been led by techies. Tim Berners-Lee, I know, is one of the guys that's been working with the site, or working with the people on the site. And yeah, with the fact that it's got wikis and stuff, they're obviously very aware that this site is probably very rarely going to be accessed by members of the public. It's going to be, there's going to be something in between. So it's going to be a site that takes a particular data set and does something with that data. That's what people are going to see. Whereas data.gov.uk is a portal for techies and nerds and data lovers. Because you mentioned earlier by email that the fact that you're really impressed that one of the top level navigation items on data.gov.uk is Sparkle. So they're really prominently placing the fact that there's a SQL query SQL-like query language for getting access to the data. So yeah, this definitely isn't for public consumption, but it looks great. And there's a few, we've had a bit of a play with it, some of the data sets and some of the apps that have been created with them, and it looks very, very promising. And again, another last of the series, the books we've been reading. For those of you who have just come in the series right at the end, we always finish off each podcast by discussing the books that Brian and I have been reading since the last episode. So, Brian, I'll let you go first. What books have you been reading these last few weeks?
About 6 or 7 months ago, I picked up a double pack at the airport of Fooled by Randomness and Black Swan. And I finished Fooled by Randomness ages ago and had cracked open Black Swan, but I finally re-picked it up now that I've got a bit more free time. Getting through it slow. I mean, it's one of these books that everyone talks about. It's not a spectacularly great book, but it's some interesting stuff in there. But the other book that I bought last week, and I literally just started it. It's called Married to a Bedouin by Marguerite van Geldermalsen. Probably really butchered that name. I'm sorry, Marguerite. But I picked it up for several reasons, partly because it's not a techie book. So it'll be a nice, you know, relaxing read from all sorts of fractal mathematics and theoretical stuff. But also, the lady on the cover looked incredibly familiar, and she was the one who married this Bedouin man. And I was trying to figure out where I had seen her. And several years ago, well, maybe 7 or 8 years ago, in the UK, Channel 4 ran a TV series called Going to Extremes, which I absolutely loved. And the author would go to the hottest, coldest, wettest, driest places on Earth. And he did that and wrote a book about it. And his editor said, it's interesting, but nobody lives there. Go do it again. And in the second series, he went to Ethiopia and he met with some Bedouins, and he was talking to this lady, and because she was also a Westerner, and kind of, you know, introducing him into the hottest place on Earth. And lo and behold, I'm almost positive it is the same lady who got married to this Bedouin. It can't be that many Western women marrying Bedouins. So it's like seeing a friend on TV on a book. So I kind of had to pick it up just to see how it is. And what about you? What have you been up to?
Just a couple of books, same as you. First, Unseen Academicals. I went into a bit of a Terry Pratchett fetish over the new year and picked up his latest book in hardback over Christmas, Unseen Academicals. I used to read Terry Pratchett tons and tons about 10 or more years ago. I used to love it, and then fell out of the habit or got into other books a while back. And suddenly, a month or two ago, just fancied reading a bit Terry Pratchett again. So got picked up his latest Unseen Academicals. Good book. Same as his always stuff. He's always quality. Slowly subversive, kind of dry humour. And enjoying it. It's a good book. And you'll be interested in this one, Brian. I was looking at something looking at an article about Iceland. I can't remember where or when or how, but the article was talking, it was a guy who had been travelling around Iceland, and all he mentioned was that Iceland had been called an unfinished land or nature's unfinished land or something like that by a Victorian traveller. And I thought, oh, that's an interesting way of describing the country. So with the benefit of Google, I did a quick search for that phrase and came up with a book called Letters from High Latitudes by Lord Dufferin, who in his youth was an author of some repute. In the 1850s, he wrote this book, Letters from High Latitudes. And after that, he went on to be Governor General of Canada and Viceroy of India and generally all-around good diplomat. But yeah, in 1856, he decided to go off and visit have a trip around the North Atlantic in a boat. And he visited Iceland, I've only just started the book, but when he visited Iceland, the population was probably 70 or 80,000 in a country twice the size of Scotland. So, I mean, and Reykjavik itself was barely more than a village, I think. So I'm really looking forward to getting into this, but it's been good so far. He's got a nice, easy style, and I'm really chuffed to have found it. So I'll lend it to you afterwards.
And how old is the book?
Sorry?
How old is the book? Like, when was it written?
1856.
Okay, so we're talking 150, 160 years
ago.
Yeah. And I think things have changed since
then.
Things have changed a little since then.
Yeah. Paywalls. That's what's changed. You wouldn't be able to read his book these days online.
Well, this has been the end of episode 11 of North Atlantic Radio. It's a shame it's taken us 10 podcasts to get to number 11 and to go so smoothly and then have it be the end of the series. But that's okay. We'll be back in a few months, maybe 3 or 4 months, with season 2. And we're going to take a bit of time off to finish a few other projects and kind of retool the system, learn a little bit more about how to podcast and get some different music, change some things, maybe add a section, remove a section. We'll try and get some feedback about, is it too short? Is it too long? Whatever. As always, our email address is hello@northatlanticradio.com. If you want to chime in with your thoughts about what we should do differently in season 2. Some of the email that we've gotten so far has been really, really good. A lot of constructive stuff. Someone once described us as a magazine for your ears.
I'm not exactly sure how to take that.
It's good. It's good.
It makes it sound much more professional than we are.
If they could only see how we're doing this. But it might be, that would be a good tagline for season 2, North Atlantic Radio, a podcast magazine for your ears. But, I mean, we try and keep it short on purpose, 15 minutes. So we can't go into super depth about different topics. So I can understand where the whole magazine concept comes from. But it's just one of the restrictions that we've applied to ourselves. In the interim, while we're not around and you really need something to fill your void of podcasting needs, we put together a few different sites that you might be interested in. There's huffduffer.com, which I don't think we've talked about as one of the side of the podcast, but it's a great little service that allows you to bookmark MP3 files, and then you can create a RSS feed or an iTunes subscription and subscribe to a tag or bookmark others, see things that other people have bookmarked. So it's a really good way to just discover all sorts of stuff, and it's really techie and scientific at the moment, so there's a lot of good stuff always trickling through. There's also progressiveenhancement.net, which is some friends of ours who are doing a podcast and all about techie and progressive enhancement and just about the web in general. That's another really great podcast. And then another one we have on the list is one called vimcasts.org, which is by a friend of ours up in Edinburgh. And it's all about the Vim text editor. And I had a sneaky little peek at it yesterday and today, and it's really, really good, because I have to admit, every time I have to do server-side stuff, I always sneak in and use Nano or Pico and try and make sure no one saw me.
Everyone pretends that they use Vi when they're doing server stuff, but in reality, a lot of either people use it and they have no idea what they're doing and they just fluke it, or people use Pico and Nano. So if you're like Brian and I and your knowledge of Vi is minimal, then Vimcast's a great little screencast that kind of help you up to expert level.
Yeah. So if you're looking bored, if you're bored in the next few months and you're looking for something to listen to or read, we can highly recommend those. I mean, we started this podcast, I think we got May 7th. So it was about 8 months ago that we've been doing this North Atlantic Radio podcast. So
it's
flown by. I think we'll take a bit of time off, retool, and come back with season two. Bigger, faster, stronger.
Yep. And if progressiveenhancement.net and vimcast.org aren't enough for you, another final podcast to fill the void left by North Atlantic Radio is the BBC's In Our Time with Melvin Bragg, which is an absolutely incredible podcast. It will cover sometimes as little as a couple of hours of a day, sometimes thousands of years, 45 minutes each week, and it will always discuss something that's happened during the time humans have been on Earth, and it's absolutely fantastic. So as Brian was saying to me earlier, if we can pretend we're at the same level as In Our Time, then that would be great.
Yeah, if you're at home sitting there thinking, man, I wish there was something to fill this void, and you instantly thought In Our Time, that would just make our day.
Yeah. Yeah, 45 minutes. I mean, it's like three North Atlantic podcasts in a row.
Yeah, and three or four experts.
Yeah.
We've distilled it down to 15 minutes and just the two of us. So.
Yeah, but so we've really enjoyed recording these 11 episodes. Hope you've enjoyed listening to them as well. And I'm sure after a few months break, R&R, Brian will be back better than ever.
Yeah, so thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoyed.
Yeah, cheers.
Bye-bye.